Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Print Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Makwana Maja. Let's get into the first news story of today. And today we're going to be talking about unemployment. And we've got our most recent unemployment data for the fourth quarter of 2025. And Makwana, unfortunately, I think for me, the real story here is that there isn't that much news. And that's kind of what we don't want to hear from unemployment. We want to hear that there is lots of news and that unemployment is going down. So the official unemployment rate decreased by 0.5 percentage point from 31.9% in the third quarter to 31.4% in the fourth quarter. So that's not annualized. So that represents, you know, seasonal changes, people going for temporary work and stuff over December, as many people do, they pick up like retail jobs or something temporarily. The more depressing statistic is that when you include discouraged job seekers, who are included in what's often called the unofficial employment rate, the number of discouraged job seekers increased by 233,000 to 3.7 million. So things are not looking great at all there. Basically, we can say that unemployment is either, when you take that standard definition, is either flat or basically up. Most of the increases were in social services, construction, finance. The decreases were in trade, manufacturing, and mining. Most of the jobs created were in the Western Cape. And most of the jobs lost were in Gauteng. No particular surprises there, I think, considering all of the governance problems that have been going on. Makwana, once again, we come back to the great problem in South Africa is that somewhere between a third and a half, I've encouraged those discouraged job seekers, we get sort of into the 40s in terms of number of people who are unemployed. We have very close to half the country without a job. And this is the central crisis of our time. What do you make of these numbers?
Yeah, I think this is why the message, the IR's flagship message, that growth is necessary and that South Africa will descend into chaos without it is so important, is that when you have a country that has now turned a somewhat positive growth rate in four successive quarters, it's still not enough, right? You need much higher growth levels of between 5 and 7% to really make a dent in the unemployment numbers. And I think this statistic is a reflection of that, is that even with those, you know, four quarters of growth, what you get in that last quarter in December is just 44,000 jobs created, much of which can be attributed to, as you said, seasonal work. So it's, and then when you also offset that against the number of job seekers that we've added, and then the number of discouraged job seekers that we've also added in that quarter, you can see that South Africa is actually not growing at all in terms of, you know, closing the gap, the unemployment gap. So it's incredibly discouraging. I always, always have a gripe with the fact that we distinguish between the official and the extended employment rates, because one factors in those discouraged job seekers, whilst the other glazes over them in an attempt to produce these vanity metrics to make the situation look better than it is. But it doesn't help that we have the false sense of an unemployment rate that's high, but in actual fact could be way higher if we took those people who have stopped looking for work because they're discouraged, not because there's no longer a need for work, but because they've just given up looking. But I think this is why the message of growth is important, and the president paid lip service to growth in the State of the Nation address, alongside admitting to some of the reasons why growth has been so stagnant. He mentioned some service delivery issues. How he even threw in broad-based economic empowerment, BEE, as not being inclusive or enabling growth. So, and mentioned that there will be reform in those areas, but we also saw attempts to continue centralizing state power. So it doesn't seem like a true reckoning has occurred in terms of the crisis of unemployment in South Africa yet, and that, you know, freeing up the markets and not necessarily hoarding state power is what's going to get us to those desirable job creation numbers. Doesn't seem like, you know, that loop has yet been closed. But I wait in expectation to see some of those reforms that will emerge, how they are implemented from the president's address at the State of the Nation.
You know, when you look more deeply into these statistics, you'd see, I think, how devastating the situation is, and why it is a growth and labor market regulation problem more than just some of these other issues. So, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, one of the reasons we have such a high unemployment rate is because we have so many people with either bad education or uneducated. But if you look at, for example, our graduate rate, that's, you know, people with tertiary education who've graduated, the number of graduates who are unemployed is like 10%, which is a really, really big number for people who should be, you know, who are at the top of the sort of educational chain. And then also when you compare us to other countries in the world, South Africa continuously rates as one of the highest, if not the highest, unemployment rate in the world. So this is our great calamity. And it needs these kind of structural reforms to the economy, not the sort of, oh, well, you know, we'll make the ports run slightly better, which will help, but it's not enough. You actually need to sort of tear up a huge amount of red tape in the economy. You actually have to reform the procurement system. You actually have to loosen up labor regulations. And this is, I think, probably the key one. So that it's easier to both fire, but also to hire people. If the cost of hiring someone is not so high, businesses will be more eager to take risks on hiring people. If you can get rid of or at least change the minimum wage so that it doesn't price huge numbers of workers out of the economy who otherwise wouldn't be hired. If we don't make those changes, and they're not popular changes, and they're difficult changes, there's interest groups, there's many people who are, when they hear this, they get worried because they think, you know, my job security will be at risk or my pay will be at risk. But if you don't make those changes, you're never going to fix this huge unemployment problem. Makone, any final thoughts on this one?
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, the government doesn't seem to have made those connections for why unemployment is so high in South Africa. And actually, when you speak of the graduate unemployment rates, it looks low, right, compared to, you know, the expanded rate, which is four times that. It's like 42%, I believe, 42% and some change. But I think when you start comparing it against other emerging markets, that's when you realize that the rest of the country's graduates are in a far better position. There's actually an incentive to go study because your likelihood of getting a job is quite high. It's almost a sure thing. And it is just as, not just as high, but it is quite high in South Africa as well, but it should be way higher. And I think all these barriers to growth we should start describing them as barriers to jobs. You know, BEE is a barrier to people being in jobs. Poor service delivery is a barrier to people securing jobs. And we have poor service delivery because of things like our public procurement system, which, you know, has ensured that we have service providers who are woefully qualified in positions to deliver those basic public goods and services to us. Those are all barriers to ensuring that those 40% of South Africans who are without a job remain in those positions, remain entrenched, you know, in joblessness. And so I think that's how we should start describing this language, is to create that link and that association for people that, well, the reason you are unemployed is for a myriad of reasons. And these are those reasons that to this day, you know, the president will still defend. He will still defend the, even though he's identified that it's actually the reason why there hasn't been inclusive growth in the country, that it served a narrow handful interests. He will still come out and defend it. So I do think those connections need to start being made, and we need to start having those blunt conversations about why actually people are so unemployed.
All right, let's move on to our next story. This one gets a little bit complicated, but it does lead, I think, into a much more interesting topic. So there is a open source intelligence group online called Impact, which runs a project called the All Eyes on Wagner Project, which is a project that attempts to sort of document the activities of this Russian mercenary group called, they originally called the Wagner Group, although I think they then changed their name to the Africa Corps after their leader, Prigozhin, was killed. But anyway, this group has been active all over Africa. They have close associations with the military juntas in Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali. And this open source intelligence group, Impact, put out a report claiming that this group is increasingly, while it's always been affiliated sort of with the Russian state, that it's become more directly consolidated under the control of Russia's foreign intelligence services, the SVR. And one of the operations it was running was a campaign to discredit the Democratic Alliance in the lead up to our 2024 elections. Now, what's interesting about this is there's not, as far as I know from the reporting on this, there's not that much clear evidence that directly links these claims to stuff that's been going on. But the Institute for Security Studies did say last year that there were around 80,000 posts made by anti-DA social that were anti-DA social media posts that they believe were inorganic. What do they mean by that? They mean that there was, rather than sort of, they're not looking here at posts that, you know, it's like, oh, I, you know, the DA is useless, they raised my rates, whatever, something like that. They're looking at posts which seem coordinated and pushed out from accounts that don't appear to be real people. The Institute for Security Studies said that it had found that there were 11 recurring hashtags, including hashtag Dumb Alliance, hashtag Stop the DA, hashtag Doomsday for DA, and a number of others that were used to frame the party in a negative light. And that there was also a website set up, dumballiance.com, which now no longer exists, as well as sort of strange vox pop interviews, which was supposedly with disaffected DA supporters, that kind of all suddenly out of nowhere flooded a lot of social media in the lead up to the last election we had. So the claim here is that this may have been partially a project by foreign intelligence. I think the bigger point though about this, and it's, you know, you can get into the specifics of this one, whether this is definitely foreign intelligence, whether it's not, whether it's effective. But Makona, I think that people massively underestimate the amount of content in social media that is inorganic. Influencers are very often paid without disclosing that they are specifically messaging for a company or a political party or, you know, anything, a project, something like that. It's very often that I think that there are a lot of accounts which purport to be real people, but are in fact either some sort of AI-controlled chatbot that has got a specific set of instructions, or is one of a number of multiple accounts being run off of one of those bot farms, which you can rent out, that are often run by people in India and Pakistan. And I think the reason this is important is because it kind of can warp one's perspective of of the political discourse in the country. Very often that you find people in South Africa say, you know, like in my day-to-day life, things seem okay, but then I go online and everyone is just so racist and so angry, and there's just so much vitriol pouring out of everyone. And I think that some of that is explained by the fact that obviously there are crazy lunatics out there who believe extreme things. But I do also think that a lot of it is being driven by inorganic campaigns that promote various points of view. What's your take on all of that?
Yeah, listen, I think this story particularly needs a lot more research because it describes these 80,000 anti-DA social media posts as being linked to a Russian operative, and the evidence they have of this is like this one person who an influencer supposedly on self-reporting said that they were actually paid between 40 to 50 Rand per post and that they were paid by a Russian person. But I absolutely agree with you that it is so important that people are aware what ideas are being marketed to them and by whom. And that's what's happening, right? It's like when Facebook introduced, is it Facebook or YouTube, introduced this obligation, place this obligation on influencers to let people know when they are watching an advert, right? So you think you're watching somebody in their home, you know, cleaning their house and, you know, talking about how effective, for example, the cleaning products are. Meanwhile, you're actually watching an advert. This person is being paid to sell you something. It should not be different for political messaging. You should be aware if somebody is being paid to sell you these thoughts, these ideas, because they are effectively products. You should be made aware if somebody is actually just sharing opinions that they genuinely hold with you, or if somebody has paid them to peddle those narratives to you, you should absolutely be conscious of that. And so I think they will, governments will probably start to introduce those measures soon enough, because people are being manipulated without them being made aware, especially like elderly populations. You've seen it with AI, people watching AI videos and not being aware and then running with that message, thinking that it's actually something that a genuine event that took place. It's so dangerous. And I think that we should be way more sensitized to that. We should be aware of whether people are telling us things because they genuinely believe and uphold those views, or if there is a foreign source out there that's trying to manipulate us by using this person as a conduit for a message that they wouldn't otherwise express. I think it can sow real division. And we've seen this with the white monopoly capital. Right.
That was the first big time that I think it became public knowledge.
And it's stuck. I think that is something that is in South African political lexicon to this day. People will tell you that you are black people will call the black people and say, you know, you're promoting white monopoly capital. And it's like, if only you knew how much white monopoly capital went into the creation of that specific phrase, right? It's stuck.
You know, this is the thing, is that I think a lot of people, and as you say, I think it is more common amongst older people in general, although, you know, there's still obviously younger people who get tripped up in this stuff too. There's this sort of belief, kind of almost a subconscious belief, that social media is like a reflection really of the public, that it's you know, the vox, it is the vox pop, right? It's the voice of just ordinary people. So when you say lots of people saying something, that it represents something real in society. But, you know, all the political parties, for example, paying influencers to message on their behalf and to say things. Everyone is involved, you know, all these companies are paying people. And as you say, I think this is actually more of a problem outside of the political space in some ways, where people don't expect someone to have an agenda. They're out there saying, you know, oh, look at this really cute thing I got from the shops, and then they just happen to drop a link to it in the description, and it turns out that they're an affiliate and are getting a cut of every sale made on that one. And it is, I think, something that requires a bit of a cultural change, is that people really have to understand that social media is very definitely a distinct and often quite manipulated realm of things. It's, you know, it's no more authentic than kind of professionally produced news media is, right? Which is like, or political party messaging or an advertising campaign. It's just a little bit more sort of chaotic. So this is not so easy to see where things are coming from. And, you know, as always, the basic rules kind of apply, which is that one should be skeptical of extraordinary claims online. And I wonder sometimes how effective some of these campaigns are. I think some of them land, right? The white monopoly capital thing was an example of one that landed. But, you know, I don't see a lot of people going around referring to the DA as the dumb alliance on social media. They'll call it other things who don't like it. But the dumb alliance didn't seem to fit to stick. So whoever was running that campaign, whether it was Russia, whether it was someone else, I don't think that was a successful successful one, but it is still something worth noting. And you know, the AI stuff only makes this a little bit more difficult, of course, because it's, in some ways, it's easier to fake authentic looking video and that kind of stuff nowadays. And it's also just, you know, really cheap. Like, anyone can get a subscription to some of these services and spin up a video that sort of looks all right, kind of plausibly, like it could be true. I don't know. Any more thoughts on this one? We'll move on.
Yeah, the Dumb Alliance is a dead giveaway for me, that this person's likely never stepped foot in South Africa. Whoever came up with these hashtags and the influencer who dared to post them just accepted them without even questioning them or applying their mind at all. But I agree, it's no more real than virtual reality. It's a stage. They are props. It's been
just
designed.
Because someone is recording a video from their phone in a bucky doesn't mean they aren't being paid to do it.
Absolutely. In fact, the more real it looks, the more it's likely to convince you as the viewer, you know, that this person's just having a long day and wants to vent off about political events. You're thinking it's completely benign, but no, this person's making a killing out of, you know, influencing how you think. So we all need to be a little more careful about that, I think. And I think, well, while the Dumb Alliance may have been silly, something like the article describes a mug that was ordered for John Steenhuisen that apparently meant to depict the DEA as, you know.
Yeah, it was. I think it was a racist mug or something. It was going to be, they were going to create a video of something of him getting a racist mug on his birthday and then claim that this was like the kind of thing that goes on in the DA to make the party look racist. And you can see how that one could have landed if it ever happened.
Absolutely. I have no doubt. I think it appeals to some experiences that I've had with people who have a deep suspicion that the DA is secretly plotting, you know, to get power so that, you know.
Yeah, they weren't showed on their face, but behind the scenes.
You know, those Barubes and them, they're all like scheming to bring back, you know, racism and to subjugate Black people. But yeah, I think that one would have worked.
And that's why, you know, we wear our sort of colors on our sleeve here. We unabashedly say we're a classical liberal perspective on things. We say that we are associated with the IRR because we are a project of the IRR. And, you know where we're coming from. You know what sort of our kind of general view on the universe is. So let's put it this way. You know what our agenda is. So you know how to compensate for that if you're not on board with that agenda. And so you can take us as we are rather than trying to work out what our secret motives are on this podcast anyway. Okay, let us move on to our last topic for today. And this is a list. Who published this? Sorry, it was the Daily Maverick. The Daily Maverick, who have come up with a list of, they say that this, the title was "A New Generation of Leaders who reshapes the Future of South African Politics." And what was kind of interesting about this list, firstly, was that of the 15 names on the list, 6 were from the DA, only 3 were from the ANC, 1 from MK, 1 from Rise Mzansi, 2 from the Patriotic Alliance, 1 from the EFF. So just before we get into the specifics of who's on the list, Makone, it is kind of interesting here that while I'm not sure if I agree with this whole list or everyone on it or, you know, the representation of certain parties and things, it is worth noting that, firstly, the ANC is underrepresented considering its importance. And secondly, the supposed great voice of the youth, the EFF, it's kind of lacking on this list. And I think part of that is because Julius Malema has sucked up all the oxygen in that party. Yes, there are talented people still in the EFF, but they are much diminished by the fact that Malema just sort of hogs the limelight in that party.
Oh, he wouldn't have it any other way. Somebody dared to like have a political presence that rose above his? Off with your head immediately. What do you mean? But I thought this was an interesting one to cover. For various reasons, including that you don't see the EFF representative, but you also only have three ANC members on there. And one of them is Ronald Zamula, who the article tells you has been
So,
in politics since he was 13. So
let me
he
go
doesn't
through the
have a job.
list
Yes, do
that
that.
the Daily Maverick gave here. Ronald Lamola, Dean McPherson, Siviwe Gorube, Leon Schreiber, Zuko Godlimpi, Ashel Serapin, Jordan Hill Lewis, Nasipi Moya, Dumasani Ntuli, Simunelo Mvulu, Makashula Ghana, Ashley Sauls, Sihle Lonzi, Karabo Kako, and Liam Jacobs. Now, I think most South Africans have heard of at least some of those people. Some of those people I think most South Africans have probably never heard of. But as you say, when you look at the, you kind of almost get the feeling sometimes that the author was trying a little bit too hard to find some ANC people to put on the list, particularly I think in the case of Ronald Lamola, who, as you say, is it's not exactly, even if he's not that old a guy, he's actually kind of been a feature, and it's not like I think he has any real surprises to give us in our politics. I don't know.
Lamola, as well as somebody like Dumisani Ntuli, who I think his profile rose at a few of these people, but specifically him because he's from the ANC. I think he's become more popular and maybe not necessarily by seeing his name, but I think for those who've been following the proceedings of the Matlanga Commission and the portfolio committee adjacent to it, will recognize his face. I think he's definitely benefited from that. I also think the DA has a few ministers in there. You have a deputy finance minister, Ashel Serapin. You have somebody like Dean McPherson. You have Garube. I think, I wonder, the cutoff age seems to be the age of 40. I wonder why somebody like Solly Malatsi wasn't considered for that, although I'm not aware of how old he is. But it seems to be that them being in government is what's put them on people's radar. Right. I don't see too many DA MPs. And I said to you, if I was to review this list, I'd want to add somebody like Dr. Mark Burke, who is a DA MP, who I think were very effective in communicating the DA's anti-VAT increase stance around this time last year during the budget debate. But I do
That's
also
great.
think that this list is primarily influenced by what's currently hot
Yes.
politically. Yes.
I agree very much on that one. Just to add to that, Solly Malatsi turned 40 about 2 months ago.
Okay, so
So that's
he would
probably
have
why they
cut.
didn't put him on the list.
Too bad. But yeah, and I would also like to see somebody like Khulekwa Hlengwa, who for me is like the first youngest, I think, non-ANC politician that comes to mind pre-GNU. He's from the IFP. Just the dignity with which I've seen him carry himself, present himself in parliament, during parliamentary proceedings. I would have definitely liked to see somebody like him presented there. So yeah, you do have some career politicians like Damola, who I personally think age is irrelevant when it comes to him if he's been in politics since he was a teenager. And we've only ever seen him hold political office for decades now. I don't think he should, personally, I don't think he should be on the list. But I'm also not somebody who celebrates young people for being in politics just because they're young. For me, youth is not important if it doesn't come with wisdom and knowledge. And some of these names, I think, reflect that. And people like Ashley Sauls, I haven't really seen him, show political, wisdom, specifically in the portfolio committee. I think also somebody like, oh, I'm sorry, Liam Jacobs, I think he's made some terrible errors in his very promising political career. But yeah.
Yeah, he's charismatic and he can speak well, but as you revealed to me, he's, I mean, I knew he had left the DA to join the PA, but you told me he before was in the ANC, which you kind of go, I mean, I know when you're young you don't always know what you want in life, but three political party jumps in such a short period of time.
Which is
Yeah,
also
I
the
don't know.
problem of just celebrating youth in positions of influence just because they're young. It's like how many of them's views have really congealed and have been tested and have withstood the test of time. I think some of them have really been a flash in the pan. We should wait, or maybe the problem is they won't be youth anymore. I don't know, but we should wait to see some of them be experience real challenges and see how they come out on the other side before we pedestalize them.
And Ron Lamola, I think, is a great example of that, right? He actually has had some very genuine experience in government over a very long period of time. He led the ANC Youth League, all these things, and his results have not been amazing, suffice to say. So I also think that it's really lame to valorize youth as just for youth's sake. It's the lamest form of identity politics because it is at one point the group that everyone belongs to. You don't have to do anything to be a part of it. It's not even it's like the least exclusive group that a human being can be part of. Is at some stage we're all young. But it is still interesting, I think, to see the sort of changing political culture that you're seeing the ANC just sort of diminish here because it is a party dominated by older people. And you're seeing a party like the DA, all the young ministers. I remember someone remarked on this quite, after the Government of National Unity was formed. The ANC are all ancient and all the DA ministers are pretty young. And it really kind of, I think, shows that what's going on in our politics in South Africa is not just simply two political parties or various political parties, that there is the ANC represents a South Africa that I think doesn't quite exist in the same way anymore, one that's sort of slowly fading away. That I think accounts for some of these differences you see in the ages of politicians. Any final thoughts before we close up?
And that personality cults, parties that are built around the personality of their leaders, the EFF, the MK, who I think each got one youth or young person represented on the list. You just see how that negatively affects the party in the long term. It's such a myopic view to take. Although I think it's less true of Jacob Zuma. I think he's just sort of fallen into that position where, he's beloved. But with Julius Malema, he seems determined and adamant that, no one in the EFF dare rise above him, lest they face the fate of the likes of Buyiseni Ntsozi. So, yep, hopefully they're watching.
All right. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow on the Daily Print Show. I won't be here on Thursday or Friday, but my colleagues shall be hosting in my stead. With that, have a wonderful day, and we shall see you soon on the Daily Print Show. Cheers.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.